We've been walking through 1 Samuel. Last week, we were in the very famous story of David and Goliath. And we enjoyed that very much. If you're reading along through 1 Samuel, you almost have to be careful not to break your neck when you go from verse 17 to verse 19, because it's like, whoa, everything changes so fast and so dramatically and so completely. And so today we're looking at that bridge in David's life and in Saul's life, where their paths just cross, and it becomes crystal clear that what happened with this giant Goliath last week was no fluke. But David is rising. He is ascending. And unfortunately, at the same time, just as Samuel has told us earlier, we begin to see Saul's rapid descent. So listen to God's word, and listen to this bridge as the story of David and the story of Saul and the story of the Messiah that is to come all intersect. 1 Samuel chapter 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand and hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." So David said to Saul, "Who am I and what is my family or my father's clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merib, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Meholah. Now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David, and when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. "I will give her to him," he thought, "so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." So Saul said to David, "Now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law." Then Saul ordered his attendants, "Speak to David privately and say, 'Look, the king is pleased with you, and his attendants all like you. Now become his son-in-law.'" They repeated these words to David, but David said, "Do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I am only a poor man and little known." When Saul's servants told him what David had said, Saul replied, "Say to David, 'The king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies.'" Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. When the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So before the allotted time elapsed, David and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines. He brought their foreskins and presented the full number to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him his daughter, Michal, in marriage. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? It's probably one of the most foundational questions that dwells within the human heart. When we meet someone new and we're wondering how we fit in, the question is there: do you love me? See, as I'm trying to decide how I'm going to relate to you, as I'm trying to decide what my posture is going to be to you, the foundational question is, do you love me? It's a question that makes children act out, because they want to find out, they want to test. Do you love me? If I did even this, do you love me? A foundational question. We often ask it out of insecurity. We're going to find out, though, that the most secure being that ever walked the earth asked that very question. Do you love me? But before we get there, let's again look at his ancestor, David. If David had asked the question, "Do you love me?" the question would have come back. Almost everybody loved David. I don't think he was greatly loved by Philistines. But if we'll set that population aside, we see that David was a loved man. The people loved David. In verse 16, we see, "But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns." The people loved David. The servants of Saul loved David. In verse 22, "Then Saul ordered his servants to speak to David privately and say, 'Look, the king is pleased with you, and the attendants all like you. Now become his son-in-law.'" The attendants all love you is a way that we could understand that verse. So if we're keeping track, the servants of the king love David. The subjects of the king love David. The daughter of the king loves David. We hear of his daughter Michal's love in verse 20. Now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. So the subjects, the servants, the daughter, and the son. Because you see, Saul's son, Jonathan, loved David too. That's where our passage began. After David finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Jonathan loved David. So the son of the king, the daughter of the king, the servants of the king, and the subjects of the king loved David. And you know what? The king himself loved David for a season. If you remember back a couple chapters, in chapter 16, verse 21, "And David came to Saul and entered his service, and Saul loved him greatly. And he, David, became his, Saul's, armor bearer." See, almost everybody. In this passage, though, we have a couple of pictures. We have a picture of exemplary love, the love that Jonathan, son of the king, had for David. And then we have the picture of Saul himself, when love leaves. We're going to spend the next moments looking at those two pictures. And then we're going to quickly paint a third picture. And we're going to be challenged to consider which picture we want to embrace. The first picture, though, is when love leaves. And the relationship with Saul and David, the relationship between Saul and David, began with a very good start as we looked at the verse we just looked at, where it was declared that Saul loved David. But in this chapter, we also see a very, very good start. In verse 2, from that day forward, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. See, David pleased Saul. The very thing that Samuel said would happen, the best of your youths, your sons, the king will take and he will put into his service. And Saul is doing this very thing with David. But he's doing it because he liked him, because he found him useful, because he wanted him in his service. So we have a very good start that quickly turns into promotions. Saul was promoting David to the highest places in his army. Verse 5 says, whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. It should have been good. It was such a good start. The people responded being pleased. The servants responded being pleased. The army responded being pleased. The ladies from the village responded with songs of praise. We read that in verse 6 and 7. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. They danced and they sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David has slain his 10,000s. And Saul's ears heard that. They did not like what they heard. You know, we actually see something of Saul's heart right here, because if we were in Hebrew school learning how to write beautiful Hebrew poetry, and somebody said, hey class, why don't you write a song of praise to the good King Saul? And they turned in this very poem, it would have gotten a good grade. Because, see, according to the rules of Hebrew poetry, you say the most important person first. So Saul's name came before David's name came. And you build in the results of their excellency. So the move from thousands to 10,000s, both of those things are the way that the poetry was supposed to work. I guess what Saul's ears needed to hear to be satisfied was, Saul has killed his 10,000s, yea, Saul's mighty men under the amazing direction of Saul have killed their 10,000s. But there, to our ears, because we have, you know, been to school and studied Hebrew poetry, we might have heard the slight against Saul, but it's not really there. Saul had to have a troubled heart to have this response to what should have been a very, very good start. But Saul grew jealous. I'm not at all qualified to actually give a grade, but let's assume, you know, it's a good B plus, maybe an A minus. Well, Saul's ears heard D plus, D minus, really, really unacceptable grades in this. We know it because we hear him in verse 8. Saul heard the poem, and Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought. But me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? If we listen closely, we can hear Saul's heart. What more can he get than my kingdom? And so Saul was angry. And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. So he was jealous. And then he was angry, and then he was hostile. When we listen to Saul, the message that isn't quite spoken here, but it's going to be made explicit very soon, is, I will kill him. I will. Jesus declared that when we're holding on to anger, we're very near murder. His servant John said it even more explicitly in 1 John 3:15. He said, whoever hates his brother commits murder. It probably shouldn't surprise us that the attitude we see in the king's heart quickly spills into murderous schemes. He's angry and he's jealous, and now he is hostile. His first attempt is open hostility. The next day, an evil spirit came forcefully upon Saul, and as he was prophesying, and there's a good chance your Bible says ranting, that's how most versions of the Bible have chosen to translate that word, that raving, not ranting, raving, having a fit in his house. And David was there playing the harp, because that was David's job that we learned back in chapter 16. This music helped give Saul relief when these spirits were doing this to him. And on this day, as it says, David was playing the harp as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand and he hurled it at him, saying, I am going to pin you to the wall. Open hostility. And in his raving, Saul seems to have done this twice. So you see, the hate of a brother has quickly turned into murder. And I named that attempt one, which was open hostility. I guess I could have named it attempt one and two, because he tried twice. But when we get to attempt two, Saul gets just a little bit more subtle, and he moves from open hostility to passive aggression. In verse 13, we see that because Saul was afraid of David, and because the Lord was with David but had left Saul, Saul sent David away from him, and he gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in the campaigns. And everything he did, he had great success. And it continues on, and Saul continued to see how successful he was, and he was afraid of him. But the picture here, and it's described a little bit more clearly later, is that Saul was tired of having David close to him, so he sent him out where the fighting was hot to let his enemy take care of David for him. So it's kind of a passive-aggressive attempt to get rid of this problem of David. But when that didn't work, Saul went to a third attempt, which was a plot. We read about it in verse 17. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter Merib. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him, but let the Philistines do that." So, with a plot of the lure of marriage, he again sends David to be defeated by the Philistines. But that plot is thwarted as well. And as such, when David had success, Saul gave his daughter to another. But it doesn't end there, because his fourth attempt at getting rid of this David is a thicker plot. We could say the plot thickens. This time he's going to use his daughter Michal as a snare. We read, "Now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David, and when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. 'I will give her to him,' he thought, 'so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him.' So Saul said to David, 'Now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law.'" David expresses his concerns. He says he's poor. He says, "I cannot afford a king's daughter for a wife. I don't have the wealth to give the king the price for a daughter." And when the king heard this, he thinks, "Excellent. He says, 'I will set a price that you can afford, but that I don't think you can pay.'" You see, this is just a beautiful Saul. The way this plan is coming together, it's gorgeous. He can't pay. I get to make the terms. I want the Philistines to really hate him so he will be eliminated. What could I do that might make Philistines really hate David? Oh, I have a diabolical idea. I'm going to send him out to do circumcisions. Involuntary circumcisions. This is all it costs, is 100 foreskins. Now, the foreskin is the piece that's left over after circumcision. So if we want to understand this, it's a lot like the North American tradition of scalps, just a little more personal, perhaps a little more dramatic. What we can be assured of is no Philistine is going to say, "Sure, here, take it." No. No. David is about to become the scourge of every Philistine. But David says, "I am pleased with that idea, because the Lord was with him." And David knew part of his call and purpose was the defeat of Philistines. And so David succeeds in a rather dramatic way. Even though Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hand of the Philistines, we find out that David and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines. He brought their foreskins and presented the full number to the king. which is a very strange sight. And yet that's what it says happened. He presented them to the king. Here, king, here is the price. He presented the full number to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave his daughter Michal in marriage. And Saul's fear grew. Saul had anger that drove jealousy, that ended up in hate and murder. And now he's left with only fear. Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle as often as they did. David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. And Saul's fear grew. It's picture one. Picture one. Love that has left. Love that has been replaced by anger and jealousy. To see our next picture, we need to go back to the beginning of the passage and look at the king's son, Jonathan, because he paints for us a picture of love. A picture of love for the anointed one, because that's who David was. He was the anointed one. And when we hear that word, anointed one, our minds should think Messiah, because that's what the anointed one was the Messiah. And maybe we should even hear the word Christ, because it has the exact same meaning, the anointed one. And so when we think of that language, it invites us to see the comparison between David and the one that came after him. Because they both carried the name anointed one, Messiah. And as we see Jonathan's love, the picture of love, the first thing we see is that they were knit. They were knit into one spirit. Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. So they were knit together. Jonathan loved him. Jonathan made a covenant. And the language is that it was Jonathan that made the covenant. It wasn't a covenant that David asked of Jonathan. It was a covenant that Jonathan gave. He said, "Let me make this promise that I am knit to you, and I love you, and I will support you in every way from this time forward." Jonathan loved him. And then Jonathan took off his robe and he put it on David. And it was a picture of royal privilege. See, Jonathan was supposed to be the next king, because the oldest son of the king is supposed to be the next king. I don't know if you've noticed, but in the news of the past month, and on the cover of People magazine and such things, you find out that's still a big deal. So Jonathan was the natural heir to the throne, but he took off his robe, his royal robe. He took off with a picture of him taking off his royal privilege and putting it on David. This picture is very complete. He took off his robe. He took off his armor and put it on David. And he took his sword and gave it to David. He took off his belt and gave it to David, and his bow. He took everything. He said, I'm promising you everything. I'm giving you everything. I am submitting to you because I love you. Because he had the appropriate love for the king. And somehow Jonathan saw what Saul could not see, that David was God's chosen one, the one who the Lord was with. It's kind of an amazing picture because you see, Jonathan had every reason to be jealous. He had every reason to see David as his rival and even usurper, the one who took from him what should have been his. But in the picture, Jonathan embraced Messiah. He embraced the Anointed One. Jonathan let the king be the king. So we have a picture of love that's left. A beautiful picture of love expressed. And let's look at a picture of love from the New Testament regarding David's future heir, his real heir, the true king, the Lord Jesus Christ. In 1 Peter 1, verse 8, Peter writes, though you have not seen him, you loved him. I'm sorry, let me try that again. Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him. Rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. See what Peter's saying there? He's saying when you come to know the King, even though you haven't seen him, but you know him, you love him. And how's he say it? What's the outcome? When we see him that way, we love him because we're obtaining the outcome of your faith. Because your trust in him results in the salvation of your soul. So when we see the way he loves us, we reflect that love back to him. Even those of us that sit where Peter's readers sat, that haven't seen his face, we have the privilege of believing him. I started with that question, do you love me? Jesus asked that question in John 21. He said to Peter, whose name was Simon, son of John, that's Peter. He said, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, that's Peter answering, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. So Jesus knew how important it was for the good of Peter. The same Peter that just wrote this promise of salvation. Jesus knew how important it was for Peter to know and express that he loved Jesus. So not out of insecurity, but with complete security, Jesus says, do you love me? Because he wants to give Peter the privilege of saying, he does. And Jesus fills in the meaning of love in places like Matthew 10, 37. Jesus has what sound like hard words. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. do you love me? We can read what Jesus said there, and if we choose to think and look in the background, we can say, you see Jonathan's love. See, Jonathan loved the anointed one more than he loved his father. Jonathan loved the anointed one more than he loved his son, because you see, if Jonathan had been king, then Jonathan's son would be the next king. And Jonathan was saying, no. I love the anointed one. So Jesus is saying, this is what that love looks like. And what's it mean to love me more, we might ask when we hear Jesus say that, and Jesus answers in places like John 14, where in verse 15 he says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Do you want to know if you love me? Do you obey me? And then later in the same chapter, whoever has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. And then continuing on, Jesus answered him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. Did you catch that? If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him. And this is what will happen, Jesus says. We. That's my Father and I, is what Jesus is saying. If you keep his word, Father will love that person that keeps his word. And Jesus says, me and the Father will come and we will make our home with you. Whoever does not love me does not keep my Father's words. And the word that you hear is not mine, but the Father who sent me. So that's a picture of love. It's not romantic love, but it's kingly love. That was the church phone. Ironic, isn't it? Kingly love. You see, the response to the king is love. And this is a love that demands setting ourselves aside. Remember the picture from Jonathan? He loved him as he loved himself. Now, each of us needs to pick a picture. Because you see, when we come before the king, we can't be neutral. It costs to come face to face with the king. You see, when you come face to face with the king, you begin to realize you're not the king. But we all like to rule. I know you. Because you're like me. You want it your way. I like it my way is the cry of the human heart. And when we come face to face with the king, we come with the realization, I might not get it my way. Because now it's the king's way that matters. So you can't stay neutral. You're forced to embrace the king the way Jonathan did, and loving obedience as Jesus showed us. Or you start scheming and trying to figure out a way to remain king. That's what Saul did. He was trying hard to remain king, pinning him to the wall, sending him to the front lines, making outrageous demands, all calculated to remove him from being a threat. That is our heart of rebellion. We can't stay neutral. God invites us to love him. God's word says we love him because he first loved us. That's foundational. If we don't realize what he's done for us, if you don't realize what he's done for you, you won't be able to love him. And we choose to love him, and we choose to let our love grow for him when we see what it is that he has done for us. The clearer we see that, the more we love. The easier it is to love. Even when it's difficult to love, it becomes easier to love because we realize that in the ultimate things, he has done this for us, culminating at the cross, where the good king, the good Messiah, laid down his life, though he was innocent, so that he could take my sin and your sin and all of the sin of the world upon himself. Take it from you, just the way the song, The Trade, that we sang earlier expressed it, to give back his very righteousness. That's what he did. He loves you when you see what he's done.